Well, welcome again. We're so glad that you're with us. If this is your first time, my name is Justin, this is Brian, and this is Theology on Tuesday. You'll see these little sheets of paper around the room. They're important for how the evening goes, because that top QR code right there, you can scan that and ask anything you want to two priests in a bar, and we will do our best to answer it as succinctly as possible in the second half of our time this evening. There are a number of other things on the bottom that I want to draw your attention to. First, you can join our email list, which I have to tell you a story. I got really discouraged yesterday when I sent out the email because like 50 people unsubscribed immediately. Or it was not even that, it was blocked my email. And I was like, now granted, it's just my business email through Gmail that I've sent it out, but it's gotta be a better way. We're gonna figure that out. But I was like, oh man, I guess like—
Or is it you?
Half of the people at Theology on Tap just no longer wanna come at all. So. Thankfully, it was not the case. So what we're going to do is you can scan that. And in fact, even if you have been a part of our email list, we're going to change platforms. We'll probably go to MailChimp. So go ahead and do that again. If you want to be on our email list, what we do is we just send out regular reminders every other week or so with, hey, we're going to meet this week, or hey, we're not meeting this week. It's pretty straightforward.
Which is especially important in the summer, because in the rest of the year, we pretty much stick to every other week, but in the summer, you never know. So, like, we're going to be right back here next week.
Yes. I know. We don't have a—
Two weeks in a row.
So, come back next week. That's the first announcement there on the right. 2 weeks in a row, and I will email out again the rest of the summer dates, which are on there. But there are a couple of other things I want to draw your attention to. One is, if you're a guy, I want to invite you. I'm going to be doing something for 4 weeks in a row during the month of June. Anybody here heard of a guy named J.C. Ryle? He lived a couple— Yeah, you have. All right. One person. He was an Anglican guy.
He's amazing.
He's really great. Some really great thoughts. But he was a bishop in the Church of England from the 19th century. And it's amazing how relevant a lot of what he has to say. But he wrote about 40 pages directly addressed to living as a young man. So he has a book called Thoughts for Young Men that I'm just going to guide a bunch of young men through. I'd love to have you join me for that. You can text me. My number's there if you want to have a question, or if you're interested, just let me know. We're going to provide lunch for that, and those are the dates. It'll be Mondays during 12 to 1 o'clock. Also, we've got a few— Yeah?
Is it four different classes, or is it you just come to any one of them?
Come to all of them, because it will change. Like, I'll break up the book.
I'll break up the book into sections.
But even if you miss one, you can still come. It's going to be a great discussion. You're not going to want to miss. But yes, it will build on each other. So, the other thing is, we have some great topics in store for the summer. But we always periodically want to get your feedback. How we choose topics is usually things that we're just frankly interested in ourselves, mm-hmm. or something that usually touches on just relevance for young adults, young professionals.
Conversations we're having with people.
Exactly, yeah. But now seemed like a good time to solicit your input. If you have a burning desire to have us talk at a future Theology on Tuesday about some topic, go ahead and scan that QR code that has a little arrow pointing to it down there on the bottom right. And then finally, I think I saw Sally. Yeah, Sally's here for Holy City Life. You're not with Holy City Life, because that's Alexandra and Mary.
But you are here.
Oh, she comes sometimes. Is Alexandra or Meredith here? That y'all didn't see the look of panic on her face that I got to see, which was delightful. But I'm just going to go ahead and designate— Sally can tell you all about Holy City Life tonight if you're interested. Or not, you can talk to me, that's fine.
Or me.
What it is a group of folks in their 20s and 30s who are looking for social time outside of Theology on Tuesdays. So this is usually every other Tuesday, and we have other events. I think they went to a baseball game not that long ago, so lots of good stuff there. That's the end of our announcements. Now,
okay.
I feel like, can you do a quick synopsis of what we talked about last time, but which is going to build off— we're going to build off of that as we talk about this week's topic.
Yes, so we are talking about the topic of addiction. And we're loosely going off this book that is a really excellent book, subtitled Banquet in the Graveyard, which I think is just such an apt image for addiction. And last week we talked a lot about how addiction is deeply related to the idea of idolatry and worship. And one of the reasons that I think this book is so important is that there are lots of things out there where you can even Google about 12 steps to stop whatever this thing is that you're dealing with that you don't want to do. But the problem is it doesn't work because you have to frame the whole issue of addiction in a way that makes sense for the way that you live your life. And I think part of what this book does is it talks about how the fact of addiction really is rooted in idolatry, it's rooted in self-centeredness, and for Christians, it's rooted in failing to really worship God and make God the top priority in our life. And we talked about the verse in the Gospel of John that we are going to keep coming back to from John chapter 10, where Jesus says, "The thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it abundantly." And the lie of addiction is that that is where not only pleasure, but joy is going to be found. But the problem is, it may produce pleasure in the short term, but at some point the switch flips and you're actually in bondage and you can't get out.
Yeah, there's this simultaneous deep love of whatever object, be it sex or alcohol or a relationship, whatever it is, you both love it and hate it at the same time. That's where the banquet and the grave is such a beautiful mm-hmm. illustration. One of the proverbs that comes to my mind is the dog returning to its vomit.
Yeah.
That's such a vivid picture. And one of the things that we tried to do last week was talk about how, you know, addiction is one of those words that, like, immediately polarizes people. They'll either write it off as, like, that's not me, or I am an addict. And it's usually one or the other. And I think what he does well, this is Ed Welch in his book, Addictions, A Banquet in the Grave, is he brings it close to home for all of us. I think just looking at the fact that we are all sinners, we all have sin in our lives, and these desires that begin in a sort of benign, we'll just, you know, it's not that big of a deal, and then all of a sudden, well, I'm in control. It was that descent. I think we talked about the mm-hmm. descent into voluntary servitude, which all of a sudden you don't have control over it. It has control over you. And on what we tried to say was, on some level, all of us know that to some degree. That experience, the experience that a quote-unquote addict has in their life is something that, in fact, every single one of us knows at least something of.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's really important to own, because I think it's really easy to think, well, addicts are not like people that are the people in this room. They're like those people over there, and they're not the people that we know, and, you know, and that's just not true. And it's really been brought home to me this week. Two different people who I love are really dealing with addiction and its consequences. They're somebody who I'm very close to who is in their early 30s and is in liver failure because of their failure to deal with their drinking problem. And it's not at all clear whether they are going to live for more than the next few months. Another person I know has been dealing with an addiction issue that caused him to drop out of school and just kind of go off the deep end. But has just recently gotten sober. And these are all people that, you know, they present well, they are well educated, they're from good families, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And what we need to realize is that could be us. And one of the things he talks about here that I think is so important, he has this couple of charts. One is this chart of descent, and the first step on that chart is unprepared. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so right, because when you don't think that you could ever be addicted to something, you are utterly unprepared, and you just blithely, carefree go into whatever it is that you're doing, and you just don't think about it. You don't, and maybe ask yourself the hard questions of, have I been going every single weekend to Upper King Street and getting totally hammered, and thinking about, well, that's just what everybody's saying, it's not a problem. But maybe it is a problem. You know, and I think that that understanding, and one of the questions he asks is, where's your love for the Lord, if you're a Christian? Where's your love for the Lord? Where is your desire to worship? Where is your hunger to be in God's Word? And if all those things are on lukewarm, you are in a dangerous spot.
Yeah, I love the image that he gives, which is completely biblical, is every single one of us is called to think of our lives as living in a state of warfare. And when you're in war, I love he has a chapter on there about staying violent. And he's talking about not physically hurting other people, but the mentality that comes with war. He says war has, there's something about war that sharpens the senses, especially when the enemy constantly hides. Issues of life and death will do that. You hear a twig snap and the rustling of leaves and you're in attack mode. Someone coughs and you're ready to pull the trigger. Even days of little to no sleep, war keeps us vigilant. And I think when you realize that we are in a spiritual battle as just human beings, right? Going back to that verse in John, the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. Over and over and over again, the New Testament talks about we're in a state of warfare. And that is against the devil, but it's also against things like the flesh in our own hearts and lives. So I think that's one of those helpful ways of just framing it, that if you think of your life, that is going to keep you prepared and vigilant and not become desensitized to the various things, which is why one of the books, obviously it's Screwtape Letters, if you've never read it, you can speak more to the premise behind the book more succinctly than I can, but I just love that because it gives you kind of a unique way of thinking about spiritual warfare.
Yeah, I think Screwtape is one of the best books that you could ever read. Basically what's going on is it's a fictional correspondence that's supposed to be between two devils, and their job is to try to tempt this guy who is a young Christian to give up on his Christian faith. And the interesting thing about the book is it's not so much about trying to like lay traps for him to like go hang out with the prostitutes or go to bars or whatever. It's more about how do we stop him from doing the things that will give him a vibrant and healthy spiritual life. And it is profoundly insightful. And every person that I've ever recommended it to has found it to be incredibly helpful. So if you've never read it, you have a real treat in store. So I would definitely, particularly with this whole idea of addiction, because that's a theme that runs through the book.
And it starts so often with an attitude, a disposition, some sort of desire in our hearts that seems benign. But I think when the way he frames the whole thing...
And maybe even might be benign. It,
right.
But can be twisted.
But twisted into something that becomes enslaving.
Yeah. And the other thing he does such a good job of, that again is fully consonant with what the scriptures teach us, is that who you are with and what the people value, the people that you are with, what they value is going to determine your behavior in a way that is far more influential than you might think. You may think I'm really an independent thinker, but the fact of the matter is the people that you're with, you will become more and more like. And so a lot of his strategy in this book is to try to tempt the guy to be with people that will lead him into paths that will cause him to stumble and fall.
Well, after last week and kind of up to this point now, we've had a lot of diagnosis about how we're probably more like a quote-unquote addict. Maybe some of us are in that state right now. But hopefully this is something, in my experience when I approach people, I just assume that there's probably something in your life that you wish was not there. And your thought patterns or behavior patterns or just things that are habits in your life that you wish would change. That have a mastery over you. And I think one of the things we want to talk about tonight is how can you experience true freedom and change in those areas? Where would you start with that?
Well, first I would say it starts by naming those things in your life, whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's porn, whether it's just time on your phone or addiction to social media. You know, there's just a whole host of things that it could be, but I think the first step is, you know, this is sort of similar to some of the principles that you hear about from AA. The first step is to acknowledge that you actually really have a problem.
Yeah.
And to look in the mirror and to own the problem without blaming it on anyone else, without making excuses for it, but saying, this is what it is. I'm going to put the skunk on the table and I got to figure out how to deal with this. But right along with that, that I wouldn't even say is a second step, but it's right at the same time, is you have to share that with someone else. You cannot overcome addiction alone.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the naming it, is actually being able to name that in the presence of other people. And that is one of the things that I think the experience of addictive behavior is, no, it's not that bad. Because I think we, at the end of the day, if you're in that kind of place, you're like, well, I could still probably do X, Y, or Z and be all right. But really, the verse that comes to my mind that is incredibly helpful and that is descriptive of where the healing comes from is, whoever conceals his transgressions will not prosper. This is Proverbs 28:13. Whoever conceals his sin doesn't prosper, but whoever confesses and forsakes them will obtain mercy. That's not confessing. Yes, it's confessing first and foremost to God, but this is where there's great wisdom and help that can be found in talking to just any other Christian. And I think it's important who you confess it to, mm-hmm. because you might get any variety of responses as you bring that out, but what are some of the responses that you hope you would hear as somebody confesses something like that to you?
Yeah, so I think the responses that you hope you would hear was, thank you so much for being vulnerable enough to share that with me. I really appreciate that that was hard for you to do. I want to walk with you through this. How can I help? That's what you want to hear. What you don't want to hear is, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. You know, that, and I don't think anybody would do that, but I think that's a temptation sometimes that we have. We don't want to deal with other people's messy things. And I think that as Christians, part of what we're called upon to do is to bear one another's burdens. And so we need to be open to that. The other thing is that you want people who will pray with you, and sort of part and parcel with the sharing it of that is reinvesting the way that you spend your time. It's very difficult. This is a stupid example, but if I said to all of you, stop thinking of a pink elephant, the thing you immediately do is think of a pink elephant. So when you just say stop whatever that behavior is, that doesn't really work. You have to replace it with something, but you also have to replace the contexts where you're tempted with contexts where you will not be tempted.
Yeah, and going back to what you said a moment ago, I think disgust is probably not the response most people would have. If anything, you certainly would not want to receive that, and if you have been on the receiving end of something like that, you know just how devastating and shame-inducing that can be.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think equally dangerous, but is probably more likely today, is just approval. It's actually
no big
deal. You
don't really have a problem.
Yeah, that's
it's
totally
okay.
Fine. That's part of, you know,
you
whatever.
Just need to dial it back a little.
And one of the things I love that he talks about in here is that if you have a set of addicted behavior, something like addictive behavior, you're probably have an unbelievable amount of guilt that is most likely manifesting either in anxiety, depression, other sorts of kinds of presenting, presenting symptoms. But actually, the root problem is you feel guilty. Mm-hmm. And I think, in addition to what you said, I would hope you would confess to a Christian. They would remind you that he who confesses his sins is actually telling the truth, right? So what's 1 John 1:8-10? No, 1 John 1:9. Whoever confesses his sins is not a liar. No, this is, I'm paraphrasing.
If
now.
We say we have
yeah,
to
there
sin,
it is.
We deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. But if we confess our sins,
there it is.
God is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness.
I needed that first line and then we were good. Yeah. If we confess, he is faithful.
You were getting there.
I was paraphrasing. I was doing the Justin edition
yes.
right there. I think I was paraphrasing it. But essentially, confessing is agreeing with God about the state of our lives. But then when you do that and you seek his forgiveness, he is faithful and just because of what Jesus has done to forgive you. And one of the biggest things in overcoming guilt, which is key in overcoming addictive behavior, is agreeing with God about what he's done for your sin, which is to pardon it, to take it as far as from the east as of the west when you just look to him in faith. And he doesn't leave you there because, as we're going to talk about, you already started to mention receiving the forgiveness of our sin is just the starting point. And going deeper into that, now you can experience freedom from the very power of that sin in your life. But there are any number of strategies that are helpful in what is called sanctification, mm-hmm. this process of becoming freer and freer from the power and dominion of sin in your life. You mentioned being aware of who the people are you're surrounding yourself with and how important that is. Is there anything else that can be really important in trying to experience freedom from the things that ensnare you?
Yeah, so I think there are several things. One is that being deeply committed to worship, I think, is really important, worship of God, because what happens is that when you are worshiping, the point of worship is to take your eyes off of yourself, off of your situation, and focus them onto the Lord. And so you are putting your energy into worshiping Him, and that automatically corrects your framework. So that can be very helpful. But I also think that trying to invest yourselves in things that are life-giving, where there are things that are going to bring you joy that are a million miles away from the things that you're tempted by. Investing yourself in things that will give you joy, which often will involve serving others. Those kinds of things, making deliberate choices of how you're going to invest your time differently, can be hugely important. And the other thing is thinking about, what are you inviting into your mind? Most of us have earbuds in, or the car radio going, or Netflix going in the background. We're just bombarded every moment, except when we're asleep, and some people even sleep with the earbuds, with all of this messaging, most of which is not good. And so thinking about, okay, what am I watching or listening to, and how is that affecting me? And I think I've already talked about the White Lotus and why White Lotus is so bad.
It's worth saying again, though.
I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand if you watched White Lotus, but White Lotus was the big sensation show that was on every talk show, and people were scandalized about this thing or that thing about it. But it was just full of things that are just demonstrably evil. But it's presented in this beautiful way, beautiful people, beautiful resort locations, gorgeous clothes, famous actors, all of that. So it's packaged. I mean, it's death that is packaged to look like something beautiful. And the problem is our culture is really good at that. And it's really easy to think, I can watch that, it's not going to hurt me. But it may not hurt you like right then, but the stream of that, it's like, when you go to the mountains and you see a waterfall, and you realize that this little stream over thousands of years goes right through the solid rock.
Yeah, which picks, I mean, what you're talking about is the power to have the courage to truly examine your life and to truly take an inventory of your thoughts, your habits, and ask the question and have an honest response of what is this forming in me?
Yeah.
And the key ultimately to overcoming sin, to experience new life in freedom from the things that ensnare us, is loving God more than we love those things that are damaging us. And I love, he has a really clever way, I think, that gets right at the heart. He was like, the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. And self-control is a key in overcoming, and part of it is, as we were talking about, to experience freedom from the things that ensnare, having the courage and the clarity to be able to examine your life honestly, and then to exhibit actual self-control, because an addict is not in control. And so how can you become self-control as a fruit of the Spirit? How can you exhibit self-control? He says, the question you need to ask is, do I really want self-control? Of course, we say that, but the answer is usually much more complex. He says, you want self-control, but you want it only in pill form, without having to break a sweat. Or you want it because you're supposed to want it. You're not thinking quite in depth about it. Or you want it, but not at the cost of saying no to that thing, whatever it is, mm-hmm. forever. You want it sometimes. You want it tomorrow. You want it, but you're waiting for God to remove it first. Or you want it simply because it will make life a little easier or save you some money. In other words, you want the misery of addiction to be gone, but you don't want the grace of God and the will of God to replace it.
Yep.
I think that's a really insightful way of thinking about what is going on in our hearts. But that's what has to happen, is learning self-control, developing more of the fruit of the Spirit in your life to be able to love God and the way He's created the world more than the things that we've been ensnared to.
Yeah. And one of the scripture verses I love about this that so often gets quoted only in part, everybody has heard the part that says, flee temptation. And that's great. Flee temptation is really important. And the word flee is a really big word, like get out, like a house that's on fire. Get out to save your life. Don't pick up anything on the way. Get out. But that's not where the verse ends. It says, flee temptation and pursue love, righteousness, faith, and peace, along with those of a pure heart. Pursue is another big word. It's a wholehearted, all-in, chasing after something, like a runner who's trying to finish their race. It's that sort of single-mindedness. But you're not doing it alone. You're doing it in the company of other people who are pursuing love, faith, righteousness, and peace. And those are people of a pure heart. And so I think when you combine those two things, that is the recipe for being able to move forward.
Yeah. Well, it's probably time. I'd love to kind of sum up, and maybe next time we'll talk about specific examples, whether it's pot or porn or something like that. It might be helpful to look specifically at a test case and kind of tease all this out. But I think tonight we've talked about some really important things, confessing it, coming out in the open. I think one of the things that's addictive behavior, sin, all these things that ensnare us, what they thrive in is being in the dark.
Yep.
And keeping your life private and deep and compartmentalized. When you actually begin to invite God into everywhere, we truly think that He doesn't see or doesn't care, and we're convinced that He's not good. But part of this is, we've talked about confessing to God and to others, agreeing with Him about it. We've talked about surrounding ourselves with others who are trying to live in the same way we want to live. And what are some of the other things that maybe in some would be helpful?
Well, I think one of the things is to really honestly look at your spiritual life. Now, if you're not finding joy in your spiritual life, think about why is that, because it goes right back to that you have to love the things of God's kingdom more than you love this addiction. And if you're not experiencing any joy in your spiritual life, you're not going to love that more. And so that is where it's a great thing to talk to an older, wiser Christian who can like maybe help you with that. Because if you're experiencing joy in your Christian life, you're not going to want to like wade into this other stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think it's the second half of that verse where the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but Jesus came so that we may have life and have it abundantly. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't appeal to you, then, first of all, that's exactly what Satan, spiritual forces of wickedness, our sin that's inside of us, is trying to convince us of,
right.
that God's wicked and holding out on
and
us.
Boring.
And boring. Yeah. I think that's even more powerful, is that it's not that big of a deal and it's boring. But the truth is, God is the author of all that is true and good and beautiful, and I would add exhilarating and adventurous, that what we're ultimately looking for is found in Him and the way He's designed us to be. And so saturating yourself in the Bible, particularly in the four Gospels, the New Testament, and becoming convinced of God's goodness and the way He's made the world to be, is key in learning to actually love those things more. Well, any other final thoughts before we throw it open to questions?
If you want something to read that will help you understand addiction, find The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and read all of the part about Edmund and Turkish Delight, and watch how it starts off as just a dessert treat that he likes, and then he ends up being enslaved by it to the point that he is literally bound in a jail and willing to sell out his brother and sisters and have them killed so he can get more.
Yeah. It's truly tragedy at the end.
It is.
Well, John, how are we doing on questions?
We're doing good. If you want to take the time to go ahead and upvote the questions you wanted to be asked first, or go ahead and ask your own question. I'll go ahead and ask the first one. How can you balance setting boundaries with showing love for family members who struggle with addiction?
That is a really good question. And I think it's a little bit hard to answer that in general, because I think it depends on the family member and what the situation and what the addiction might be. There are some people who are addicted that if they come into a family gathering, they will destroy it. And so that may be a boundary where you have to try to maintain your individual relationship with that person without including them in a larger events. But I think that one of the things you have to look at is what is the potential harm to others that can come here. And so one of the things that we talk about often in the Christian faith is that it is important to love the sinner but hate the sin. And so the way that you set boundaries needs to communicate that you love the person, that you care for the person, but that the flip side of that is that you are not going to allow their sin to damage other people.
Yeah, I think the real thing is not the question of boundaries in themselves versus love, but how you discuss and enforce boundaries is more important than maybe even the boundary itself. Because ultimately, one of the things that we've tried to talk about is being able to have compassion for those in the throes of addiction begins when you see yourself, actually the root of that is in my own heart. When you actually begin to think, wow, I see this in my own heart, mm-hmm. my own life, or at least the beginnings of it. And so if it weren't for God's grace, I know I would end up in a very similar position. That gives compassion for the person that you're trying to love who may be in addiction. But as we talked about last week, one of the things that's really important is actually speaking the truth in love. And so as you're compassionate, it is unloving to conceal and to pretend like it's not
There's
a big deal.
Wrong.
And, yeah. and so being able to hold up a mirror, even, and this is where it's so particularly difficult, is often those who are in the throes of addiction may not actually agree that there's a problem going on. And your job time is to remain calm, don't take it personally, but to just politely and kindly hold the line about what is good, what is right, because ultimately you can see that they are harming themselves. And your job is to help them, your job is to help speak the truth so that they may come to believe the truth. And to how you do that should be cloaked in compassion and kindness, but it is absolutely speaking the truth, which is kindness as well.
How can you support someone close to you with addiction if they haven't invited you into their struggle?
Yeah.
That is a great question. He actually talks about this some in the book. And I think one of the things that you have to do, it all depends on the strength of your relationship, but if this is a strong relationship, then I think at some point you have to take the risk and say, you know, I love you deeply, I'm committed to you, I'm committed to our friendship, but I have to be honest with you that I am very alarmed about what I see as potential issues that you're having with whatever it is. And you may not want to talk about that, you may not even see that, but as someone who loves you, I want to speak the truth to you that I'm concerned, and that if there's any way that I can help walk with you in dealing with this, I'm more than willing to do that. Most people will be disarmed by something like that. Some people will get furious and say, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore. But I think if you really are concerned, you have to risk having that conversation.
Yeah. He does talk about how, several decades ago, they probably would have said, until somebody reaches rock bottom, it's of no point to even talk about it. And more of the up-to-date studies are showing that's just not the case. In fact, it's often somebody who's courageous enough and kind enough to do that, just what you said, to risk speaking the truth in a loving way. And you know, you have to take into consideration like when and how you do that. If somebody else, ultimately, the reason for doing it is not because you or somebody else is in danger, but hopefully because this person themselves is being harmed by the very nature of their addiction. But love always draws near and takes the initiative. And again, the posture is really important. And if you need to build the capital, the point is that you're leaning in, yep, as opposed to standing off.
Right. Yeah.
How would I navigate being addicted to something that is good, like being a workaholic, and God commands us to work?
It's a great question.
That is a great, yeah, question. And I think that part of the issue with things that are good, which I think we can say work is good when it's in its proper place, is that when it gets beyond its proper place, it impinges on other things that you are commanded to love by God. So if you are a workaholic, you are unable usually to be deeply invested in relationships. You're usually unavailable to be involved in service to others. You may find it really difficult to be fully committed to worship. And I think that is a problem. And one of the issues, again, is that if you're in an industry or a type of job or even a corporate environment where it's just normal that everyone does that, you don't realize how really out of kilter you are, because you're at work all the time and the only people you see are other people who are working all the time. So I think getting a reality check is important. I also think, you know, being honest about how much am I investing in the things that Scripture says are to be priorities, that's a good clue as well. And also to think a little bit about, why am I wanting to work this much? Am I more interested in the material rewards or the approval of my employer than I am in what God says should be my priorities?
So I was trying to find that. Anybody familiar with the David Foster Wallace commencement speech that he gave
about in water?
Yeah. This is water. Well, in this is I don't think he was a Christian. He ended up taking his own life, but he did have a really insightful part of this commencement speech. I commend you to go and check out David Foster Wallace's commencement speech that he gave. I don't know how many years ago it was now, but probably a decade.
But it's really good.
He basically talks about how it gets to this question of, like, there are many things that are good that you can invest with such meaning that it will destroy you. Mm-hmm. That is called idolatry, basically, from a Christian standpoint. But he says, and he has the honesty, even as an atheist, to say there is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships something. And so he ends up talking about, if you worship money and things, again, those aren't necessarily bad in and of themselves. If they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. You'll never feel like you have enough. And you worship your own body. Again, your body is a good thing, or beauty, or even sex, which is something God made that was in the beginning good. You will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power. You will feel weak and afraid. You will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. And worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out.
Yep.
And there's several things in there that he talks about that are innately good, right?
But when you carry to an extreme,
you will end up becoming a shallow, fearful shell of a person. And that's why, it has so much to do with addictive behavior, I think.
So that's a really good thing to read. There also is an excellent book by Tim Keller that's called Counterfeit Gods, that's about idolatry of work, idolatry of sex, idolatry of all these various things. So.
Yeah.
Have you seen fasting and prayer break addiction as your time as pastors?
Yeah.
Yes.
And we should probably say more than the same word twice.
But we said it together.
Yeah. How have you seen that?
So I think one of the things that is really important about fasting and prayer is it causes a thorough and complete break with whatever the behavior is. And it is one of those ways of replacing. So you've replaced whatever it was with this absence, but it's an active absence. Fasting is an active spiritual discipline, as is prayer. And sort of the point of fasting is that as you're fasting, you're contemplating and you are meditating on scripture, and every time that you feel a thought about whatever it is that you're trying to break the addiction to, you turn that into prayer. And so what it does is it begins to break the hold that the addiction has on you.
Yeah. Fasting is one of the ways that you recognize your needs more than anything. And I think addictive behavior, the reason you end up becoming addicted is you're looking to this thing to satisfy some desire, and eventually it has a hold on you. And fasting is a radical break where you acknowledge your absolute inability and dependence, and you look outside of yourself to God. And prayer is one of those means of grace where we deepen our relationship with God. And as we do that, as we set our minds on these things of God and just try to meditate on Him and the truth of His Word, it is filling us with His very resurrected life.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key, is not some kind of magic pill, but deepening your love and connection to God in such a way that it begins to overflow in all of the areas of your life. And when that becomes a tangible reality, you can start to experience a deeper love for God and the good things He's made in their proper place.
Yeah. And I would say also fasting and prayer, when you are in the context of an accountable relationship with someone else, not something that you've just decided to try to do by yourself and not tell anyone, if you've got somebody who's in the trench with you, that makes it a lot more effective.
Yeah. And I would say too, like, there's a way of doing fasting and prayer that is really a kind of, I'm trying to still be in control of everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's a danger. You don't want to approach the spiritual disciplines as a sort of religious checklist that ultimately I do these things, God will reward me. It's not how it works.
Yeah.
It's recognizing that you're in need, and these are some of the ways that God has promised to meet that need, and looking to Him for help. Yeah.
Does it become a mockery to God at some point to continue asking forgiveness for the same sin over and over, i.e. addiction?
I don't think that there's ever a point where God looks at His beloved children, I don't care how many times, where they've asked for it, sincerely asked for it, that He is not joyful to extend more grace and forgiveness. And I think becoming convinced of that reality is one of the keys, because I think what the devil wants to do is make you believe that there is a place, there is a point where God will be stingy with His love and grace. And so I think that's a really important thing to realize. And there can be a point where you become flippant, and I'm not saying that, I think that's a separate thing, where you're being trite about your acts and about God's grace. You're presuming on it. I think that's a problem, but that's not what this person's asking, I think. And what else would you say to that?
Yeah, and I would say one of the things about that is, and I think he actually talks about this in the book, but one of the things that is really remarkable in Jesus' teaching is the stories he tells to illustrate some of these points. And he could have made up any story that he wanted to make up, but he tells the parable of the unforgiving servant, where the one servant has basically owes this debt of like $1 billion and ends up being forgiven by the master, and this other servant owes like $5 and cannot imagine forgiving that debt. And Jesus talks about how we are to forgive our brother from our heart. And he talks about how God is like that master that forgives that huge debt because he sees what's in the heart of the one who's begging for the forgiveness. So I think that God's forgiveness is, you know, there's an old hymn that says that there's a wideness in God's mercy like the wideness of the sea. And I think there's a deep truth in that. And what Satan wants to do is to convince us that it's three strikes and you're out. And I just don't think that's the way that it is. I do think, though, that, you know, if you find that you're confessing the same thing over and over and over and over again, that probably is a good clue that you need to invite someone else into that situation to talk with about that and pray with you and try to find a way of escape.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. That was, I think, an important point is recognizing God's forgiveness is always, he's ecstatic to extend forgiveness. The parable of the prodigal son is a great example of somebody who doesn't even have the right mentality of trying to come back and repent. He's trying to work his way off, but the father is lavish in his forgiveness. Yep. But, as you said, it's really important to consider if you're noticing you're asking for the same thing, it's a really good indicator that something needs to change. Yep. And approaching either a wise Christian friend or counselor, something different needs to start. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over expecting a different result. You're standing before God is secure, but the freedom that's on offer is worth trying something different to experience that. A couple more.
How do we best break addiction to success or money?
That is a great question. I would say one of the things is to honestly think about, what do you believe your meaning and purpose is? What do you believe the meaning and purpose of your life is? And to really deeply consider that. And again, part of this depends on who you're around all the time. Some of y'all have heard this before, but back when I was in my first career, I had what a lot of people thought was like the dream job of all dream jobs, where I was making a fortune, and it was very clear to me when God called me to leave that, but I also kind of was like, well, when I leave, it's going to leave such a huge hole, probably the company will go out of business. You know, I thought I was so critical, and they were telling me that all the time, and you know, when I tried to quit, they're like, no, you can't quit, we're going to keep you on the payroll for 6 months because we hope you're going to come back, you know, all that kind of stuff. They didn't care less. I mean, after that 6 months was up, they got somebody new in that job and they forgot about me completely. And so we feed ourselves these lies about how important we are. That's just not true. And so I think gaining perspective is the most important way to break the hold of that.
That's so right. How, you know, and often it's these subtle things that we're not even aware of that are telling us the standard of what success should be and how much money we should have. And it's like, you're not even aware of the fact that you've been imbibing all of these lies, basically. It's funny, this morning, one of the things I was reading in Luke chapter 10 was Jesus sending out the 72. And he told them as they go, the harvest is plentiful, the laborers are few. So pray to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into the harvest. Go your way, I'm sending you out. Carry no money bag, no knapsack, no sandals, and greet no one on the road. Whatever house you enter, first say, peace be to this house. And he goes on to say a number of things, but at least what stuck with me there is, now this I think has particular relevance for ministers, but I think it, on a secondary level, is something about all of Jesus's followers, all of his disciples are called to a kind of humble dependence on who he is and a simplicity of living. No knapsack, no, I think they were to rely on others, and their standard of living was, you know, if we have clothing, if we have shelter, if we have some food, then the New Testament talks about, yeah, that's what you need. And Jesus says, look to the lilies of the field. This, are they not clothed with all the splendor of Solomon's temple, right? And so our standard is so skewed based upon the world. Frankly, like, we live in one of the most luxurious places in the world of any time. And the reality of what you, and this is why, you know, going on a mission trip, like, if a short-term mission, there can be a lot of great good that's done, but probably the greatest good is that perspective
right.
that you yeah. gain going and seeing how other people live, and you realize, oh, wait a minute, you want to know how not to be tied to success or money, is go look at some of the poorest people in the world and the joy that they have in their lives. It will provide that perspective of what your the simplicity your life truly needs, I think. One more.
Okay. These are great questions.
Yeah. In what ways does trauma and wounds, emotional, mental, or spiritual, affect addiction?
That's a great question. I think that it very often sets you up for addiction because it seems like you've got to have something that you can use to cope with the pain and basically to medicate the pain. And I was just talking with Justin, we were starting all the songs. One of the things y'all probably figured out, songs on the playlist all have something to do with theme, but there's a U2 song that's called Running to Stand Still. And it's talking exactly about this, of these people that have had all of this trauma. And it says, I took the poison from the poison stream so I can float right out of here. And I think that's exactly what happens to people. And so I think that when you are dealing with trauma and pain, it is really important to reach out to get good Christian, not secular, but Christian counseling about how to walk through that.
This is a book, it's hands down the best book I've ever read on finding freedom in unwanted sexual behavior. And so the book is called Unwanted by Jay Stringer. One of the things that he talks about in there is in fact about how trauma, particularly growing up, often, as you said, sets us up. Now, we're still responsible agents who make choices, but the key is not beating yourself up with shame, but coming to have a level of compassion the way God views you. With great compassion, and learning how, even if it was a small instinctive emotional response that was purely coping in the moment, it has led to a pattern of life where you have voluntarily chosen to live in serving something that will ultimately destroy you.
Yep.
And so this is a great book, the best one I've read on finding freedom from sexual sin. And I encourage that to you. But I think trauma is one of those major things that, and that's why, you know, sin is not just something we do. It can happen to us. Mm-hmm. But then these complex dimensions of, we often respond to the thing, to the sin that has hurt us in sinful ways too. And so it's usually far worse than we ever imagined. But the good news is that there is more power and freedom than we could ever hope for too.
Yep.
In Christ. So, well, this is good. I think we'll, should we do another one on these with teasing it out? Or maybe
yeah, not? I think we still got more.
I think there's still some more. Maybe one more. There's a lot of stuff. I love that one on success and money tonight. I think that was. I'd love to do some more of that and other ways that we can flesh this out.
Yeah.
But
and so, also, if there's something like this that you're struggling with that you don't feel like you have anyone to talk to, please talk to one of us privately. Either set up a time or catch us tonight. We don't want you to just be at a loss.
Yeah, I hope this is the kind of place, this is what our dream would be, where you could speak honestly and not experience condemnation, but you can actually experience people who are able to deliver hope and help in whatever you're experiencing.
Yep.
So thank you all for coming out. This has been a lot of fun for us. We'll be around to carry on the conversation, and we'll be back next week.
Yes, next week.
All right, thanks,
guys. Thanks for coming.